everyone. Welcome back to the Queens of Social Work podcast. I'm your co-host, Queen P.
And I'm your co-host, Queen H.
We invite you all to join us this week as we share, laugh, cry, and learn through our experiences as women of color who happen to be social workers.
So let's get started.
We have exciting news to share with you all as we launch our new career series. We have talked on this show about how varied the field of social work is. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons I became a social worker was due to the fact that I knew I could do so many things with this degree. So in our career series, we'll be speaking with social workers in fields that you may not have previously thought of.
Yes, Queen H, there are some social workers who do all sorts of things. There are social workers who work with the FBI. There are social workers who work with Department of Parks and Recreation. We're all over the place and we're doing many things.
That's right. And so today we are speaking with Lindsay Bendel, aka Queen L, who is a nationally recognized non-capital mitigation specialist. Beginning her career in Colorado as a public defender social worker, Lindsay has honed her skills over the years to provide support on all levels of cases, from pretrial to post-conviction. Lindsay has worked on cases across the U.S. and has assisted in obtaining freedom for multiple clients. Ms. Bendel is not only skilled in writing reports that persuade judges and prosecutors to lend mercy, she's passionate about criminal justice advocacy and ensuring that every client's story is told. So with that, welcome, Queen L. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm honored to be a queen today. Thank you so much.
That's right. Yes.
Welcome, Queen.
Thank you. I'll take my flowers.
Absolutely. Please do. Please do. So tell us, Queen L, what are your credentials, certifications, if any?
Yeah, so I have my MSW from Metropolitan State University of Denver. I graduated with that in 2018, and then I pretty much directly went into work at the public defender's office. So I worked there for 2 years doing all of my clinical licensure. And then in the state of Colorado, we do LSW is like the pre-licensed, and then LCSW is the fully licensed. So I worked towards my LCSW while I was at the public defender's office. So now I am a licensed clinical social worker. And then, so they're not technically like certifications, they are certificates. So I have a certificate in forensic social work from the National Organization of Forensic Social Work. And then I have a certificate from, oh my God, it's so long, it's NASAMS, National Alliance of Sentencing Advocates and Mitigation Specialists in mitigation. So yeah, those are my credentials.
Amazing. Amazing. Listen, sometimes there's so many different credentials, certifications, so many things we can get. So, you know, it's so great when you can find something that's geared to what you want to do and you can really hone your skills and get that extra education. And so with that said, like, how did you get into this field?
Okay, so I think that this is going to be like an extra funny story for this podcast. Are you ready for this?
We're ready.
All right, well, I was your very classic white woman. in grad school, I was obsessed with true crime, right? Because like, I didn't have a ton of people in my life that were touched by the criminal justice system. I mean, I do have people in my life, but certainly their cases went very differently than a lot of the clients that I ended up working with. And so, like most average white women, I was obsessed with serial killers and learning more about them and their history and the psychology and their stories. And that's like one of the things that like got me through grad school. And so it just so happened that like right as I was graduating, the public defender's office posted these open positions for the first round of adult social workers in the state of Colorado. And when I read the job description, I was like, holy crap, I could do true crime for work. How cool is this? So very much like not going into it with the mindset that I have today. It was just like, oh, I'm fascinated by this. And so now I'm going to get to do it full time. Well, that's cool. And I got the position. And pretty much the day that I walked into that office, everything that I knew, especially about true crime, right? Like flipped on its head.
I can imagine. I can definitely imagine. I mean, you know, I know, look, white women are obsessed with true crime, but I'm a little obsessed with true crime myself. So, and I'm not a white woman, so I don't know what that says.
I mean, it's like a phenomenon, right? I think especially like us in social work, there's so much crossover with psychology. My bachelor's is in psych. So I've just always been interested in like the quote unquote, like I would not use this term now, but like what we would call a psychopath, right? Or like quote unquote antisocial behaviors. I hate that term too. But what's going on inside of a person's brain, right? I think like that's what it comes down to for a lot of us.
I agree. And so yes, Queen H, just like you said, not only white women, but for sure, social workers in general, I think have an affair with crime and true crime, especially because like you said, Queen L, there is definitely a crossover between psychology, pathology, you know, patterns of behavior. We're talking about multi-service systems, you know, all of those things kind of cross over into one lovely woven basket, I would say. And that's how we end up, you know, kind of in that space. So you said that you do forensic social work. Can you tell us what is forensic social work and what role does a public defender social worker play in mitigation? Like, are you a defender? I would think that would be an attorney. So what is the nuanced role that you play?
Great question. That was like a three-part question. So if I forget something, keep me on track, okay?
I will, for sure.
So forensic social work, great question. The definition is on the National Organization of Forensic Social Work. I do tend to be careful when I define forensic social work because, you know, forensic social workers can be anyone that work in the criminal justice field. I personally don't want to be confused with someone that works for police, right? Those are technically forensic social workers. I don't want to be confused with someone that works in the prison system. Those are forensic social workers. Like really anyone that works like in the criminal justice field can technically be a forensic social worker. What I like about the NOFSW, the National Organization of Forensic Social Work, is that when they do their annual training, they've really like got a hold of like through the years, like the different branches of forensic social work. And so they've kind of like made branches of their training so that like they do have a track for mitigation specialists, which is what I am, which we'll get into. They've got branches for people that do like policing type work. And they might have some other tracks too, but I know like those are the two main ones. So forensic social worker, like broad term, anyone that works in the criminal justice field. Public defender, another great question. Where do I start with this one? So social workers started to become a major part of public defender's offices after the Bronx Defenders really created the first what's called holistic defense program. So originated right in NYC. And the Bronx Defenders are kind of like the leading organization on holistic defense. And what holistic defense means, I'll ask you guys a question. Can you tell me what it means when someone is assigned a public defender?
So when someone is assigned a public defender, my understanding is when, let's say they've been arrested and they need counsel, then they would be assigned a public defender if they cannot pay for an attorney. That's my understanding.
Yeah. I mean, Queen H, you're right on track. So an unfortunate word that we use in public defense is indigent, right? Like that's the quote unquote qualification. You have to be indigent. And you're right on par. But I think as social workers, I mean, again, I'm going to throw this on you guys. What does it mean to be indigent? How does one become indigent?
My understanding of indigent is like poor, needy, someone who is in need of service. I mean, and that is a term that we use in medical social work either. As a matter of fact, that's some of the criteria that a person has to meet in order to get specific services or connection to social work services in a medical healthcare setting.
So I guess, would it be safe to say then that indigent is kind of an intersectional term, right? Like the way that someone becomes indigent is intersectional. It's not just because you've committed a crime. It's not just because you need medical care. It's probably because there is some sort of connection between all of those things, right? Behavioral health, medical health, legal, all of those things. So the Bronx Defenders thankfully recognized this need and said, why are we just giving indigent clients legal help when we know they're going to show up at our door again within the next year because they don't have housing, they don't have food, they're struggling with drug addiction, they're not taking their medications, they don't have a doctor, right? Like all of these different intersectional things are at play. And so thankfully, the Bronx Defenders was like, we're not doing this anymore. So they started Holistic Defense. They started adding social workers as part of an interdisciplinary team to their public defenders offices. So anyone that they like went through the process and decided needed a social worker assigned, you know, they automatically have their attorney assigned through the courts. And then if they believe that their case was appropriate for a social worker, they would also assign a social worker. The social worker would work on social work things, right? Get them housing, get them into treatment, make sure that they had food on the table, make sure that they were connected to the local mental health center, all these types of things. And that kind of took the public defense world by storm. You know, there are some offices that are still not, like some like very rural offices, of course, that are kind of like living in the past and they're not quite there yet. But like both major cities now are super on board with holistic defense. And because of that, public defender no longer means an attorney. Public defender means an interdisciplinary team of individuals that are working to help resolve a case. There's usually an investigator involved, right? Because on public defense teams, like the investigator like orders all the records, checks out the scene of the crime, takes the pictures, so on and so forth. The social worker, the attorney, the paralegal, the admin, everyone that works for the public defender's office is a public defender.
Okay, wow. You know, it's very interesting because I think many systems now are really starting to see the need to look at things as a whole versus as a compartment. Oh, I'm only dealing with this, right? For instance, in healthcare, it was just like, okay, what do they need physically for their physical health? Then realizing, no, we need to look at them as a whole person. That's where medical social work comes in. That's where if you have certain types of programs within the hospital, like a hospital-based violence intervention program, all of those things kind of do the same thing. And you work as an interdisciplinary team to try to help the person heal in the best way that they can, taking into account that if you do not address the social determinants of health, how is their physical health going to get better? No, you need to take care of their whole person. So it's good to hear that that is what public defender's office is doing. And so with that said, I'm going to assume that you work directly with clients, but if you don't, you can correct me. And then you spoke a little bit about the services, but can you talk about, you know, the services that, you know, you, your agency provides for the client that is presented to you or that comes in and needs your services?
Absolutely. So you're right on par with that. I do all direct client work, right? Like everything I do is going to be in unison with the client. And that's part of also the public defender's office kind of starting to take a more person-centered approach, which is wonderful. So I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of mitigation just because I think it's kind of important to like better understand like what I do with clients. So I am what's called a non-capital mitigation specialist. However, mitigation was born from capital cases. Capital cases are death penalty cases. It's where death penalty is on the table and the mitigation specialist is fighting for life instead of death. The perfect example of this, whether you agree or disagree, is the Parkland shooting. You guys familiar with the Parkland shooting, Queen P and Queen H?
Yep.
Okay. Should I go over a little bit or do you think it's widely known enough?
No, I think you give people a little brief so that they know, you know?
Yeah. So the Parkland shooting was an absolutely terrible thing that happened in South Florida, where I was born and raised and went to school myself in the same county. And what happened was this young man just turned 18, went to school. He had fallen through a ton of cracks in the system. He went to school one day after dropping out right after his 18th birthday, and he shot a bunch of his classmates to death in a horrifying way. He had fallen through many systems before this had ever happened. And the way that I look at capital mitigation and capital cases, death penalty cases in general, is that usually what happens in these types of cases is that the system fails the person, and then they turn around and say that it's the person's fault, and then they try to kill the person. And this Parkland case is like the perfect example of this. So it's been argued that this young man was born with fetal alcohol syndrome. We know that he was born to a mother who was absent and who was a sex worker. He was given directly to his grandmother, and his grandmother never knew how to handle him and wasn't given the proper resources to handle him. And because of that, he went his whole life pretty much untreated. I don't know exactly what the school did to try to help them, but whatever it was, it clearly was not enough because the grandmother never felt like she had the resources or intervention that she needed. So eventually things completely spiraled out of control. This young man was able to purchase a gun of mass destruction and was able to go to the school and commit a heinous crime. And because it was so heinous and because it's Florida, he pled guilty, which is what we often see in death penalty cases. They'll plead guilty in hopes of trying to escape the death penalty. However, the prosecutor and the victim's families were not into giving him life, so they fought for death. And the death penalty, what we saw was a trial, but it's not your traditional trial, right? Because he had already pled guilty. So death penalty trial is where the jury gets to decide whether or not they are going to sentence the defendant to the death penalty. And during that death penalty trial, you have aggravating evidence, which is what the state prosecution, state attorneys, whatever you call it in your state, they provide the aggravating evidence. So in this case, some of the aggravating evidence was the surveillance cameras that were showing him going up to children point blank and shooting them in the head. It was pretty terrible. And a discussion for another day is, by the way, these jury members don't get any mental health resources. So that's a story for another day. Talk about intersectionality. And then the defense, the public defenders in this case, they present what's called the mitigating evidence. And so mitigation are things outside of the crime that took place that don't excuse what took place, but explain what took place. How did this child get so lost? What brought him to that day? And the Broward County Public Defender's Office was successful in presenting their mitigating evidence, which ultimately saved him from the death penalty. Do you have any questions about that?
No questions. And thank you. That was a great explanation and synopsis of all the things that went down. And that was very comprehensive, I will say. So moving away from that litigation piece and legal piece a little, tell me more about the social work aspect of your role. Let's say, for example, this Parkland shooter was your client, and you said that this is an 18-year-old male who has fetal alcohol syndrome, was raised with a grandmother who didn't get the tools, resources to kind of support him with that diagnosis. If this case came to your desk, what would be the role that you would play as the social worker within the interdisciplinary team?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, that was kind of the background history. I do non-capital. I do non-death penalty. So thankfully, this would never come across my desk. But I do specialize in first-degree homicides, just not of that level. So when I get a client assigned to me, the first thing I want to do is meet with that client to immediately start building rapport. A lot of my clients are incarcerated, so I have to go to jails, prisons, federal prisons a lot of the time. You know, some of this has to be done quickly, just especially working with like federal prisons. They don't like to give you a whole lot of visits. You got to kind of take what you can get. So I would love to be able to take like multiple sessions to build rapport. That's just not possible. So after maybe an hour of building rapport, I do a super in-depth biopsychosocial assessment. My assessment is 16 pages long. I want to know every single thing about them. I want to know where they were born, how they were born. I want to know their milestones, their developmental milestones. I want to know where they went to school, how they did in school. I want to know what they were like as a teenager. Where did they grow up? Was there lead in the paint on the walls? I want to know everything that I can about them, children, married, all of that, all, like really in-depth biopsychosocial assessment. And then from there, identify what I call mitigation witnesses. So these are people that know the client very well, their family members, their best friends, their spouses, maybe coaches, maybe teachers, mentors in some way. And I want to interview them. And what I want to do is A, corroborate what my client reported to me in the biopsychosocial, and then B, get an outside view of what went on with this client throughout their life. After I get all of that information, I tie that together in a report, sometimes a presentation, along with evidence-based research. And then I present that to either the prosecutor or the judge to get hopefully a more lenient sentence.
Wow. See, now I wish I would have known about this in social work school, because I know. And Queen P, listen, you like to write a report. You like to tie things together. This would have been right up your alley, okay? And it's not like you can't change, but at the same time, we already on a path, girl. So I don't know about switching at this point. I'm too old.
You know, but when she says 16 page, girl, my mom went on foster care. Do you remember those foster care permanency reports we had to do?
Oh, geez. The fast, the court action, the court documents, the...
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. And you know... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I'm going to say, and don't let your child need services. You would have to do some kind of biopsychosocial to get them in a crisis center for 20 days, you know, and just writing all of this stuff. And sometimes, a lot of times, you weren't even a social worker yet. You're a caseworker having to do all of this. So it's like, you know, that's right up our alley. That's all I just wanted to say about that piece. You know, we know this to be true, but we're still asking it anyway. Can you say that you've seen any inequities in the criminal justice system? We know that's true. And if so, what has that looked like? And can you tell us about a case that expanded your knowledge and your skill as a social worker?
Queen H, what are you talking about? The criminal justice system is exactly the way it's supposed to be. It is not broken. It is running exactly the way it was intended.
Girl.
Yes, I know y'all know. I know y'all know. Yes. The inequities are far, and they are vast, and they are awful, and they will kill your soul slowly but surely. Gosh, there's so many cases that come to mind. There are so many like different things that come to mind. I think the first time I realized how truly fucked this system was when I worked what's called a felony murder case in Denver. This is super complicated, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm just gonna start with that. Felony murder is basically, It's like guilty by association almost. So Queens, let's say that you and I are going to go rob a house, right? That's a felony. But we're like, you know what? We're hard up. We need to go rob a house because we need some money. Okay. So the three of us go to a place in the Bronx. We rob the house. We go in all this together. But what I don't tell you guys is that I'm holding, right? So I've got a gun on me. I never tell you guys I have a gun. You don't know I have a gun. We get to the house. The entire intention is to just rob them. And then when we get there, we don't realize. We think no one's home, but someone ends up being home. I pull out my gun. I shoot them. They die. You guys did not kill them. You had no part in killing them. But guess what? Y'all are going down on homicide just like I am. And it's going to be felony murder, but it holds the same exact amount of jail time as first degree homicide. Y'all didn't know I had a gun. You didn't know a gun was going to be brought. You did not touch this other person. You did not kill them. But y'all are also going down on first degree homicide. How do you feel about that?
It's a mess. And actually, I had one of my mom's good friends, that happened to her son. He wasn't a part of anything, but he was there. Matter of fact, he didn't know what was going on, but he just happened to be there. And he got 20 years as a young man. He was like 20, 21 years old.
You see that, right? I had a case in Denver. And what was really unfortunate about it to me, and again, like when I was like, oh my God, this is extra fucked, is like, there was a lot of Black culture involved in it, right? Like this whole thing transpired from some sneakerheads. Right. So they were setting up basically the example I gave, like a robbery of sneakers. And it was like a handful of Black kids. And my client had set up the robbery through, you know, like a Craigslist type of thing, and was not actually there when the robbery took place. He was just part of it from like that sales aspect. And then the other people went there. He wasn't even there. They ended up shooting the kid and killing him. And so my guy goes down on felony murder for like 40 years. And just like you said, Queen H, he was like, you know, 19 years old. He was a young Black kid. There was just like a ton of trauma in his family, a ton of poverty, and they slammed him. And that was like the first time that I really had to take a step back and be like, holy shit, what's happening here?
So what is happening here, Queen L? You know, how did that case expand your knowledge and skill as a social worker? You know, what is happening?
Girl, if I could tell you what was happening, I think I'd win a Nobel Peace Prize. really though.
Okay.
What is happening is like, you know, like deeply ingrained institutional racism, for sure. How did that expand my knowledge? It showed me that none of us are safe, and especially if you are a person of color. And a person of color in a majority white city, that no matter what crime you commit, even if you're not at the scene of the crime, you're going to end up paying the maximum price. You know, I've seen it before and I've heard it before, but it's just so different when, at least it has been for me, right? Like, you know, my family, I'm just like this crazy liberal progressive, like, oh, there's Lindsay again talking about, you know, this woke shit. But I've sat next to people on the literal worst days of their life where they were sentenced to life in prison, and that shit changes you as a human being. And so I had to take a step back for a week and fill my tank, but I came back to fight harder. And I feel like, you know, also as a white woman, that's something that I think is appropriate for me to do, not as a white savior, but as someone that has the ability and has been able to pass through the system much easier.
Just to go back, you said something about the case included Black culture. Now, what was it? What was culturally Black that involved that case, other than them just being Black? You understand what I mean?
Oh, I certainly do. So Colorado, very white place, right? So I think when police see that this was around sneakers and was sneakerheads, I think that they equated this, right? Well, like, these are some Black hoodlums because this is a Black thing. And that's not to say that that doesn't cross over, because there are a ton of white sneakerheads. Do you guys know Philly at all? I live in Philly. Do y'all know Philly at all?
A tiny bit.
Familiar, for sure.
Yeah, yes. A tiny bit. It's a little something.
Do you know about our ATVs, our four-wheelers here, and our ATVs?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
like,
yes.
To me, like, there are white people that do that, and there are Latino people that do that, but, like, Meek Mill will tell you, like, that is quintessential Philadelphia and Baltimore, like, Black culture, and I absolutely love that about this city. Like, that is something, if you want to talk about Black joy, those wheelie gangs, when they're rolling by, like, oh my gosh, they are having the best time, and it's something that they get to do together as a community. And I feel like sneakerheads has also become something of, like, Black community that brings Black joy, that I've at least seen throughout my experience, but please correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I understand. And I understand what you're saying. So because I wanted to clear it up for the audience, because there were other points that you were making. So I didn't want it to come across as you're saying the robbery was Black culture. I wanted you to explain it out. And so I'm glad that you explained it out, because for us, the next question, and we ask everybody this, because, you know, how we show up affects our clients, the people that we're serving, and the work that we're doing with them. And so in your practice as a social worker, do you consciously think about the intersection of who you are and what role you're being? And so who you are, gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera, like those things.
Girl, I have to. Like, I think my life would be a lot easier if I could ignore it. To be just like completely transparent with you, like, when I started my private practice, I had a huge falling out with my family. Like didn't talk to my family for a year, because I would try to tell them again and again and again how much, you know, there's a lot of, oh my God, what's the word? It always escapes me. What's the trauma, the secondary trauma? And what's the other one that we get?
Vicarious trauma.
Thank you so much. There's a ton of that. And it's hard to explain because some of it feels like racialized vicarious trauma to someone who is white, but someone who has spent a ton of time in federal prison with Black men and has felt like they have been therefore like some way victimized by the system. And it's just like, my family just couldn't understand it. And, you know, they would tell me that I need to pick myself up by my bootstraps and I'm just, you know, I need to do another day. And I couldn't take it anymore. And that was like a huge thing that made me think about like, who am I in this role? And like, how am I different from my clients? And why am I feeling so much vicarious trauma through this? Because at the end of the day, I'm going home and I'm getting in bed with my cats and my clients have to sit in federal prison all night, you know? So like, I really had to sit with that and take that and do a ton of therapy around that, but then also still be able to build rapport and talk with my clients like they're human fucking beings, you know?
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so you do think consciously about your practice as a social worker and the intersectionality that you have in your role, in your work. And like Queen H said, you know, it is about showing up as we are, you know, old school social work, like the social work that, that H and I do. But H is becoming a little bit more modern. exactly. but you know, social work, just being a blank sheet of paper and being available for people and not really showing up is the old school way of doing things. And to hear Queen L that you are just showing up in your white womanness, that's all you can do. You know what I mean? That's all you can be. And to just be available to people who don't look like you, who aren't you, who the only way you can relate is really through compassion and empathy. You know what I mean? Through those core social work one-on-one things, you know,
I try to show through my work, you know, like
yes, exactly.
I don't look like you and I can't relate to you, but I hear you.
Yes.
And most of the time, 99% of the time, I'm the first person that's actually there to listen and not judge.
Yes. And that's the privilege of being a social worker. That's the beauty in it, you know, that you even have access to this. You know what I mean? So that I'm sure that the work you do, you know, will, I don't know how long you plan to be in this, but it will definitely inform your life going forward, you know? So my next question is, I understand that you have an education program. So tell me about your program and where will you be in 10 years?
Yeah, girls, you're going to be the next ones to take it because you're so interested in forensic social work and non-capital mitigation.
I love it.
Yes. And we would love to have you. Something that I want to be able to do in the future after I have it like a little more set up is I'm definitely going to do scholarships for people of color. There's not enough people of color in the field. And you know, I think it's just going to be such a powerful attribute to have more people of color in the non-capital mitigation field. And so that our clients can speak to more people who look like them and understand them better. So I love to talk to you guys about that in the future. So my education program is called Mitigation Mentor. It is the first and only on-demand education program for criminal defense-based forensic social work and non-capital mitigation. That is a lot of words to say. If you're a clinician, you can learn to do what I do. I walk you through it. I provide templates. It's a whole course. It's on demand, so you can take it at your leisure. I offer consulting, all of that fun stuff. In 10 years. So I'm actually also applying for my PhD right now. So I'm applying to WashU in St. Louis, and I'm applying to Wayne State in Detroit because non-capital mitigation is so new. It's actually newer, like within the past decade, that what I have found through my own research is that there's actually no empirical data on outcomes of non-capital mitigation. So that is a hole in the literature that I personally would like to fill because what I want to be able to do is advocate for more funding for mitigation specialists and for the courts to take mitigation more seriously and weigh it more heavily during sentencing. So that's kind of like my ultimate goal in the next 10 years is to do policy advocacy for non-capital mitigation.
Wow, that's amazing. I think, you know, Queen P and I always discuss about how to monetize your gifts, right? It's not that we don't want to help people. We can help people, but we don't have to be poor, broke, and struggling to do it, right?
Let them know.
Exactly. So you know, there are ways to do that. And I will say this, you know, if you're going to ally, right, this is the way to do it, is to bring more people of color, right, into the field, because, you know, social work and many other spheres, but social work in particular are dominated by white women, right? And so, yep. But yet a lot of the client base are, you know, people of color. And so, you know, we need to be in this sphere because there's a certain understanding intrinsically that we have of what's going on. And I think to hone the skill, it would just be beneficial to the process. So I'm glad that you're doing that. And I'm glad that your goal is to fill that gap and that hole with that data. And this is what we have to do, people. We need to find where there's holes in the literature, where there's holes in the services, and plug it in, you know, become that leading expert, become, you know, that person that they have to go to in order to know how to navigate, how to do it, right? You know, this is what we're here to do. And so with that said, what is it that you want? What is important that you want to let the people know? What do you want everyone to know?
I want to let people know that what you hear and see in true crime is not the full story. Remember, there's always two sides of the story, and then there's the truth. And just because what you see in the media and what you hear on the news, that's not always the full truth. And that no matter what crime has been committed, there is always, always, always a person underneath that.
That is so poignant. You're absolutely right. The crime is the action. It's the behavior. It's the set of circumstances, things that happen. But you're right. People are behind those things. And at the end of the day, we're all having a shared human experience. That is a great, great note, Queen L. All right. So tell us, how do the people get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I have an Instagram at True Crime Social Worker. See what I did there? So the tagline is that I'm spotlighting the other side of true crime, right? So instead of just saying this is the bad guy and this is why they should go to prison, I'm actually saying here's the story of the bad guy and are they that bad after all? So that's kind of like the main way. If you ever need a mitigation specialist, I do have a private practice, communityjusticeservices.com. And then when I have the course up, it's not up and running quite yet. It should be in the next few months. That will be at mitigationmentor.com. If it's something that you're kind of interested in getting into, I offer consulting. I offer trainings. You can always reach out to me through Instagram, or you can find me on my website and shoot me an email.
Wonderful. And we'll make sure to add all of that to the show notes so everyone knows how to find you. Thank you so much for being on and talking to us. You know, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, our podcast is for all social workers, but we also want to be able to highlight stuff for new social workers coming in and talk about all the possibilities, because many of us know that when we went to social work school, especially Queen P and I, they weren't talking about much and all the different things you could do in social work. And as you got into the field, then you learn. I've said it before on this podcast that if I could do it over again, I would be working for the FBI because I want to kick in the door and wave the 4-4. Like, I want to do it. So,
girl, you don't want to be a cop.
I don't know. I don't want to be a cop, but I want to be the social worker and do all the other solving stuff. I don't want to be the cop. I want to do it, but they still get the gun, okay?
What do you think they do with those guns, girl?
Listen, I got to protect myself.
I'm all for personal rights here.
So I just want to be there on the scene and talking to the people and doing all of that. But there are just so many different aspects, and it doesn't have to be the same common things. And there's nothing wrong with becoming a therapist. There's nothing wrong with working in child welfare and all of these other things, but there's also other aspects to the field that we can do and where we can be. And that's what we need to see. That's what we need to hear more of, so that these young budding social workers know that there's nothing holding you back. There's so many different options. And so again, thank you for being on. And yes, guys, we're going to try to do this career career series, and, you know, at least once a season has someone on that does something different than we usually expect, or even if it's something that we know, but they're, the way that they do it, the aspect that they do it, that can highlight a difference, or, you know, the variety in the field. So thank you so much, Queen L, for coming on.
Yeah, of course. And I forgot, I want to do one more plug that's not for me. There is actually the first of its kind Color of Mitigation conference that's happening this summer. I think it's in Atlanta, but don't quote me. And it's specifically for people of color that are interested in getting into mitigation. So if you're interested in that, definitely reach out to me and I'll connect you with the people organizing that. That's going to be huge.
Y'all hear that? Listen, get on the conferences are good. Get in there, network.
For sure. Networking is everything. That sounds like such a great opportunity. Thank you for sharing that, Queen L.
Yeah, happy to. Thank you guys so much for having me.
If you guys want to connect with us on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at the Queens of Social Work Pod or on Instagram at the Queens of Social Work. If you want more information on the topic we discussed today, feel free to check out our show notes or email us at thequeensofsocialwork@gmail.com. We'd really appreciate it if you rate, review, and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.